ज्ञानमिरन्धस्याज्ञानञ्जनशलाखया चाक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नाम श्रेष्ठं मनुमापि सच्चिपुत्रं मत्रास्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमुरूपुरीं माथुरीं गोष्ठावतीम् राधाकुन्दं गिरिवरं महो राधिकमधावसं प्राप्तो यस्य प्रतीतकृपया श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि। वंशकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्य पतितानां पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। निखिलश्रुतिमौलिरत्नमालद्युति निराजितापदपङ्कजन्ता आजीमुक्तकुलैरुपश्यामनं परितस्त्वं हरिणं संशयामि। अनार्पितचरीं चिरात् करुणयावतीर्णा कलहो समार्पयितुमुन्नतोज्ज्वलरासं स्वभक्तिश्रियम्। हारीपुरता सुन्दराद्युतिकदम्बसन्दीपितः सदा हृदये खन्दरे स्फुरतो वासचिनन्दनः। अजानुलम्बिता भुजो कनकावदातो सङ्कीर्तनाय कपितरो कमलाय तक्षो विश्वम्बरो धियावरो जुगधर्मपालो वन्दे जगत्प्रियकरो करुणावतारो। लादिनी शक्तिस्वरूपाय गौडाङ्गसुहृदाय च भक्तशक्तिप्रदनाय गदाधर नमोऽस्तुते। हे कृष्णकरुणासिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेशा गोपिकाकान्ता राधाकान्ता नमोऽस्तुते। राधे वृन्दावनादिशे करुणामृतवाहिनी कृपया निजपादब्जादस्यान्मयं प्रदीयतम्। भक्त्या विहीनाय अपराधलक्षाय क्षिप्ताष्टाकमादितरङ्गमाध्ये कृपामयित्वं शरणं प्रपानम् वृन्दे नमस्ते चरणारविन्दं वृन्दे नमस्ते चरणारविन्दम्। श्री सचिनंदन गौर हरि की जय। श्री श्री गौरनिताय की जय। श्री गौर गदाधर की जय। हरि नाम प्रभु की जय। कार्तिक व्रात की जय। साधु संग की जय। गौर प्रेमानंद। गुड मॉर्निंग टू ऑल। प्रणाम। वेलकम अगेन। थैंक यू सो मच फॉर sharing with all of us every day. Today we are on day one. Ever fresh, ever new. That wouldn't be the case. I think it's like day five or something, but let's keep it on day one. So it's six, five, anyhow. So anyhow, we are continuing with our series of explorations around evolution and divine love. Yesterday we had this some sort of exception to the rule that we try to connect with the contents of the work, exploring Sri Damodarastakam, you know, beginning of Kartik. We had a two-part exploration of Sri Damodarastakam, trying to get a glimpse of what we are singing on a daily basis. We are celebrating, hopefully not only on a daily, monthly basis, but even beyond that. Besides that, so far we have talked about themes like deconstruction, paradox, what else? Love, Sri Radha and her month, Sri Damodar and his lila, and his robe, and his belly, and how all of that is worshipable, and his earrings. So let's talk about us now, a little bit. Let's talk about who we are. What's the jiva? What's the soul? What's not the jiva? What's not the soul? What's our potential? And all these different themes related to the soul, right? In my book, as you know, for those who have read it, I don't want to assume that you have read my book. There are four chapters. The first one corresponding to love, second one to God, third one to the soul, and fourth one to matter. So somehow we have shared some considerable words about the divine, Radha and Krishna, in their different forms, divine love, the nature of love. So we can just spend some time now on us. Again, not a separate, entirely separate unit from everything else, but let's talk about the soul. And then in a few days also we'll try to touch on the chapter about matter, material energy as well, trying to encompass somehow the main themes of the work in the context of evolution in divine love. So chapter 3 of the book is called Mapping the Soul's Unbroken Potential. So it's an exploration of who we are as units of potential. That's a very interesting way to respond, and someone asks you casually in the grocery store, who are you? Well, you can just reply, I'm a unit of potential. And so you are. Probably you will have an interesting conversation with the guy at the grocery store after giving that reply. So that opens the door for interesting relationships and conversations. So you know what to answer when someone asks you, who are you? So we are units of potential, and this chapter is called Mapping the Soul's Unbroken Potential. So I like to add the word unbroken, because many times we over-identify ourselves as broken units, broken bits and pieces, and we may even use the words brokenness. And I'm not denying there is brokenness, there's woundedness, there is stuff, wounds, trauma, things to heal. But all that does not belong to the soul, okay? The soul is not broken. The soul is complete. That's what the Ishvapanishad mantra says, as we were reciting the other day. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamodachate Purnam 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 Purnam. That's basically what the mantra says. Everything is Purnam. Everything is whole unto itself. Related to other whole, the soul, the whole, the source whole, the source of all other wholes. We're whole with W, whole. The world is whole, complete. We are whole, complete. God is soul, whole, complete. The problem is somehow we are not aware of that. We are living as if that's not true. It's like if you have an inheritance that makes you a multi-billionaire, but for some reason you are not aware of that, then you are living like a homeless person. You could be living another type of life, but somehow you are not aware of that you are, as I was reading yesterday, one poem from Hafiz, that you are the heir of the infinite, meant to inherit all the gifts of the abundance of love coming from the divine. So the Srimad Bhagavatam says, when describing love, bhakti, ahaituki apratihata. So bhakti love is causeless, it's its own cause, and it exists for its own cause. Love comes from love and goes to further love. It has no separate, it's not coming from something else, it's not going anywhere else. Love is for itself and by itself. It's the ultimate reality. So apratihata means unbroken. Haitukim means for its own sake, for its own sake, for its own fulfillment. And apratihata means unbroken. The current of love never stops. It's unbroken, always flowing, always growing. So when we as souls put ourselves under the shelter of that love, our potential is unbroken. And we realize our unbroken potential, our capacity for love. You know? All that we can be, which is way more than who we think we are. Not to insult your conception of yourself at present, but just to leave the door open that probably you are way more than what you think you are. No? And leave that door open. No? Be careful with concluding, putting you in a box and saying, this is who I am. End of the story. Because probably then you end up doing the same with every other living entity that crosses your path, including Krishna. Right? As we were talking the other day in the paradox meeting, we want to think outside of the box. So whatever we have put into boxes, into labels, we want to go beyond them. So the soul has unbroken potential. We are units of potential. When we put ourselves, look in the direction of divine love, pay attention to it, become present to it, our potential becomes, we experience unbroken potential. We experience unlimited possibilities, really. We bear witness to all that we can be, which is beautifully overwhelming, like Srila Siddha Maharaj will say. Whenever you have a genuine glimpse of the infinite, you realize that there is no limit to progress. If you catch a genuine glimpse of infinity, and you in connection with infinity, you realize there's no limit to how much progress I can make. I have an unbroken potential. I am at wonder and at who I am, basically, and the potential that accompanies me in my core in connection to love. His own words, Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita in chapter 9, when he says that vim prakritimashritaha, sorry, mahatmanavstumam partam daivim prakritimashritaha. He says, the Atma, the soul, becomes Mahatma, great soul, daivim prakritimashritaha, when it takes shelter in the divine energy. Those are his words, but it's basically saying the soul, a unit of potential, experiences unbroken potential, becomes expanded, big, grows under the shelter of divine love. Daibim prakritim. So there is a particular section that today I like to explore from this third chapter on the soul's unbroken potential, which is based on one expression by Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. He will say in his own words, speaking about this same thing, the soul, each of you, has volcanic energy. No, volcanic. You're a walking volcano. Watch out with that. No, watch out how in which way you choose to erupt, right? So the soul is possessed of volcanic energy, and then I clarify that in the title, for better and for worse. So I'll try to bring some note of caution and warning. You're a unit of potential. Be careful what you do with that amount of energy you have. Again, sometimes the problem is that we are not aware of how much energy we have. And as we will see, that can go in two directions. One, we are underestimate our brightest potential and we kind of conform to be a half-baked version of ourselves and do not end up being all that we can be. Or we explore our potential, our great energy in very dark directions and we end up creating disaster and chaos all around us. And still, that should be when we see that in us or in other people, that should be a very clear reminder. Look how much potential, how much potency you have. And all the harm you can do, but express in the other direction all the relief, healing you can provide to yourself and to others. So one word in Sanskrit for the soul is tatashta. We are tatashta shakti. We are units of potential, units of liminality. Can we use that word? Liminal space. We can choose. We have free will to choose Do I express my potential in this direction or in other direction? Potency presupposes potential. That's an important point I try to make in the book. If we speak about potency, any potency has potential. No? So we are potency, we are Shakti, energy, potency. So potential implies becoming. If I have potential, it implies I can become so many things. The potency has potential to become. So what will we choose to become? What will we like to become? If you could dream wildly, what's your ideal self that you can visualize in your heart? And what can we do to get closer to that? And probably as we get closer to that, we realize actually I can become so much more than that. Because even our wild imagination in terms of what's my ideal version still falls short for all that we can be. But anyhow, we have to get closer to that with our present tools and gradually in the context of, again, a higher current of knowledge and higher current of revelation, we can get a further glimpse of, wow, I'm realizing that I can be way more than what my wildest imagination was showing me. It's astonishing. That's why Krishna, when Krishna speaks about the soul, as I always like to say, chapter 2, verse 29, if you don't believe me, go there, take note of the verse. Hey, nobody's taking note. You believe me? Thank you. But that chapter, Krishna is saying what the soul is not to begin with. He starts with the via negativa. No, the soul cannot die, it's not born, it's not dried, it's not burned, it's not this, it's not that. That's who you are not. Which is okay. Sometimes we need to deconstruct. Speaking about deconstruction, that's what Krishna does at that point. Deconstruct all the ideas that we may have about ourselves. No, you don't die. You don't do this. You don't do that. You don't undergo this. Okay, something positive about the soul? And Krishna's like, what to say? Okay, there's so much to say that sometimes when you have so much to say, maybe you end up saying nothing because you're overwhelmed, but or maybe you're just okay, I will say a word. And so much is there. He chooses that one word, which is Acharya, which he repeats three times, which means, again, there's so much there, but you have to translate that through with one word, it's wonderful. He said, like, you are wonderful, wonderful. I'm looking at all of you, you're wonderful. You can tell that to each other. You're wonderful. You're wonderful. You're wonderful. Yeah. It's funny because we are not accustomed that someone comes on a casual basis and they're like, you're wonderful. It's like, thank you for doing me such a favor. No, I'm not doing you a favor. It's just who you are. Right? But we don't believe it. So when someone tells you you're wonderful, it's like you are giving me something that I didn't have before. Okay, yeah, you are giving me awareness of who I am, but actually I'm already that. Not by my own merits, as I always say, not to become proud, like now after the class we were walking there, I'm wonderful. I'm wonderful. Because everyone else is as well, and it's not our own merit, it's just we happen to be wonderful. That's what the soul is. No, let's not try to find a way of explaining, but how did I get to be? I mean, that's who you are from time without beginning. But it's a beautiful gesture of affection just to remind each other to mirror wonderfulness on a daily basis. So why not? Why not just walk and say, you are wonderful? You don't need to say that to a person once in a year for their birthday only. And not even that we say sometimes, even once a year for Christmas or for Jemma. Okay, you're wonderful. And what about the other days of the year? You never say that. So that shouldn't be a formality. That's my point. No? Expressing appreciation for the wonderfulness of every being should not be made a one year in a year formality, but it should be like become like daily currency because that's who we are on a daily basis, ultimately. Beyond all the other stuff that may need to put into place, integrated, heal, salt on a more psycho-emotional level, which also we'll address that tomorrow and these days. But that's who we are again. We are a unit of potential. We are a unit of infinite possibilities, ever evolving, infinite possibilities, because our brightest future lies under the shelter of divine love, and divine love is ever evolving. So if divine love is always growing and expanding, our potential in divine love is always growing and expanding. And that's who we are. So that's interesting, because who you are is not something that you can put the finger on and finish. Okay, that's who you are. End of the story. You are a unit of ongoing infinite potential. So there's always something else to tell, to say about who we are. There's always another page to fill in the book of our lives for eternity. Because we are units of potential. We are human beings, but also we can be human becomings, as I like to use that word. It's not only about who we are, but all that we can be. I mean, sometimes we are not being too human. So first we may need to work on human beings. And when you properly understand what it means to be a human being, then you're less, my being includes my becoming. They're not separated. That's why the word be is included in becoming, right? Coming to be, and again, and again, and again. So in regards to our potential, our brightest potential, let's start there, no? Because in my book, I talk about ever-evolving potential, but ever-devolving potential, if we choose to express our free will in the embrace of avidya, so to say, of ignorance. But first, our brightest potential. I always like to recall again Śrīla Siddhārtha Mahārāja once telling a disciple, "Your future is brilliant." That's it. That's enough of a statement for eternity. When a genuine seer of reality sees you for who you are, sees you in terms not of what you did in the past, who you are in the present, but all the brightest future that is waiting you in your becoming. So your future is brilliant. But my past is so dark and my present is still messy. Yeah, we can talk about that also, but still, your future is brilliant. You cannot deny that. We may not be able to see that for sure, days, let's be honest. Some days are more sunny than others in the inner landscape. But those who keep seeing reality for what it is, those who keep seeing that the sun is shining 24/7, no matter how clouds are over here, if you will be in the sun, it's day 24/7, right? So those who have that vision of reality that is always bright, always brilliant, always evolving, they will try help us to see how our future is actually brilliant. And a way to start to glimpse that and to feel grateful and happy for that, as I also like to say and mention in the book, is that we have all the reasons to celebrate right now, right here, because we are already doing what we would like to do forever. We call that bhakti. As we spoke this day, bhaktya sanjatiya bhaktya. The goal of bhakti is
bhakti.
not liberation. No, more bhakti. Okay, so bhakti for the sake of bhakti. So you're already doing bhakti and you want to do bhakti forever. So you're already doing what you want to do forever. Therefore, you're already saved. Literally. I remember when I was Father Richard Rohr in a retreat last year in Mexico with him, and they asked him to share some words of blessing, and he said, let's stop losing our time thinking whether we are saved or not. Let's stop asking that question, because that question has already been solved forever for those who choose to live this type of life. And so we can invest our time in better questions. Right? Because will I be saved or not? Will Krishna be angry because I didn't chant 16 rounds last weekend, and I will be born as a frog next lifetime, and these. How many lives this will take, all this calculation machine. If you are doing what you want to do forever, that's it. You are there. Now, the next question is not when I will be saved, because in one sense, you already been saved. The question is, what do I do with my salvation? Still, there is a question. Not like, I'm saved. Let's relax now. Forever, no. I'm saved. So, what to do with my salvation? How to serve? How to love, how to show gratitude, because That salvation is a gift. The fact that we can engage our life energy in ways that we feel I could be doing this forever. That's also a gift of grace that we are invited to reciprocate. So that there is a question there, how to serve, how to give back, how to return embrace, right? So what to do with my salvation? No, please don't get neurotic about that. At the end of this lifetime, the last breath, a mosquito may come. I will look at the mosquito. I will leave my body thinking about mosquito, mosquito next lifetime. And I will lose the chance for bhakti for who knows, 3 eons. Come on. You think that Krishna is that such a bad guy? No. And as we were talking at the beginning of this retreat, hopefully we can have glimpses of eternity these days all together when we can feel, oh, I could be doing this forever. I could be with these people forever. I think I can't tolerate them for eternity. Joking, joking. But that's the idea. That's how you actually enter the spiritual world, right? Experiencing things of that type, like, oh, I could be doing this forever. This is sustainable in eternity. I see myself doing this in the afterlife, no? Sharing in this way on a daily basis with this. So when you start to have those glimpses, oh, and one says, you're already there. It's just a matter of time that it becomes more and more condensed and deep and broad, and there's no end to that. So again, there's no end to that. There's already a beginning to that. You're already on the journey home, right? So that's in connection to our ever-evolving potential. And we can celebrate that today, and we can feel happy and grateful. We have so many genuine reasons to celebrate life. And that's what kirtan is ultimately. Like, kirtan is life's celebration, a celebration of all that is coming and an attempt to return back. In kirtan, we are see, acknowledging the gift, saying thank you to that, expressing gratitude, but also expressing longing and desire to return the embrace and love back. It's not just thank you, God, for all that you've given me. See you tomorrow for more. But it's a back and forth, right? So in kirtan, there you have those dynamics, the giving and receiving. So all the few words in connection to, again, who we are in terms of ever-evolving potential, but also bringing some honesty to the conversation. There is something called ever-devolving potential. With this, I'm not want to sound like Maharaj is getting dark now, where we are going. But just being honest. It's not just like I do anything and I'm just correct always, and there's nothing I can do to make things worse. No, we can also go explore darkness. We can also, there is no limits in how much we can go up. We say the other day, there is no limits how much we can degrade ourselves. Just take a look at the world and things that are being done in the name of humanity that we never maybe have ever thought about it. Every day, I mean, I'm not suggesting you just immerse yourself in the world news on a daily basis because that can be too much. But just being softly a little bit sprinkled with that, you even become astonished, like, wow, to that level we're falling, getting down. So that's possible. And of course, when you look at the life of those souls who embrace their ever-evolving potential, you become overwhelmed, like, oh, to that level you can, huh? So both things are there, coexisting simultaneously, like we were talking in Glastonbury. Bhagavatam describes Kali Yuga, and it starts describing it as the worst age. Welcome. But then at the end of the book, starts to glorify Sankirtan Mahaprabhu and the benefits of the age, and it starts to basically conclude saying, oh, Kali Yuga is the best age. So it's like, oh, it's the worst and it's the best at the same time. You choose which version of it you inhabit, so to say. And still, when you choose to inhabit the ideal best version, still you are in contact with the worst version and the potential to visit that section as well. Well, let's be honest, it's not like it's black and white. I'm fully in the embrace of the best version of Kali Yuga. I don't know what's that worst version. You know, sometimes we go shopping from one to each other, so back and forth. So gradually we take full shelter in the ideal version of it, so to say. But sometimes we also go in the other direction. So we talk these days about avidya, ignorance, or avidya means lack of knowledge. We could say vidya, if Krishna says Raja Vidya, bhakti is the king of knowledge, so avidya means lack of bhakti, lack of love that keeps proper awareness of things. So when in the proportion, it's not black and white, proportionately to how much we are in that situation of avidya, of ignorance, of lack of love, lack of proper orientation and education, we may miss the mark a lot. And you know, missing the mark in hamartia. In the Bible, the word sin actually was the archery term, archery term,
Archery.
missing the mark, missing the mark. And it's healthy, I will say, it's humbling and sobering to develop, have some well-developed insight about our capacity for missing the mark. Not to over-identify with that and to feel I'm that, I'm a mark misser. That's my identity. But if we don't have a well-developed, realistic capacity of how much we can miss the mark, we may have no deep insight into what's our higher capacity for good. No? Because one is informing the other. Again, it's not just, okay, I have the capacity to do this beautiful, bright thing. Yes, but also you can become a dictator. If you allow that to happen, if you choose to walk that road and go deep and deep and deep and deep and deep into that. So one thing is informing the other indirectly. So it's good to keep the two of them in place. So tomorrow we'll be having our grief exploration there, the day, sorry. In connection, of course, to grief, to pain, to suffering, many times coming as a result of our own choices, as our own missing the mark, other people missing the mark in connection to us, resulting in trauma and abuse and wounds and so many things. So I was thinking, sharing some thoughts today, as I'm already doing, but a few more, if you allow me. Like trying to build some bridge into today's conversation and exploration. And concentrate a little bit of this potential for evil and darkness and pain and suffering that we all have, but trying to understand it in a healthy way. Again, not in a traumatizing way, not over-identify with that, but also acknowledging that soberly. So I like to read one section from the book. You had the book, you can also join me. This is page 11. So this is at the very beginning of the book. I'm talking about love in that chapter, ever-evolving love, la la la. And at one point I read it and I feel like, okay, we have to speak about suffering and pain and all that stuff also, because now this sounds too naive to la 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 la. But there are some other stuff in the conversation.
Thank you.
Page 11 starts with la la la. So I'm talking now. I'm on page 11. So I've been already 10 pages talking about love as ever evolving, as ever fresh, as ever new, as ever beautiful, as ever everything. So I try to sober myself. So I put, but what about the suffering we see in the world? Is it realistic to speak of ever expanding love when each day brings new forms of abuse, dysfunction, and pain? Is this concept of ever evolving love merely a lofty ideal? Detached from the reality of human suffering? Hopefully not. Because again, we can use everything as spiritual bypassing. Let's talk about love whole day, love, love, love. But only one part of love, which is only like, how to say, you speak English better than me, which will be some adjectives. I mean, like, only like cheap version of love, only like cozy love, and only like, you know better words than I, which is Lofty, yeah. Thank. That's why I'm asking you. You have those words in your. I don't have them. No. So when we speak about love, we want again to speak about love coherently and realistically, and for that we need to bring some of these other things in the conversation. While pure love is by nature ever growing, we don't deny that. Those unaware of this fact experience reality from a different perspective. And again, it's not black and white. It's not those who know and those who do not know. There are degrees of this. When we are disconnected from love's unfolding nature, we create conditions not for ever evolving ecstasy, but for ever devolving suffering. Something that can become worse and worse. This is one of the risks of love. Its voluntary nature means we can also choose something else. Ignorance, separateness, and pain. Yet, in the end, love is worth every risk. So we'll continue in a minute, but so love has those risks. Our love has to be voluntary by nature. It cannot be an imposed, no, I cannot even say choice, because if I say imposed choice is an oxymoron. One word is canceling the other. So you have to have the option of choosing to love. But for you to have the option of choosing love, you have to have a second option. Of course, right? Because if I say, okay, love is voluntary, you can choose to love. Okay, what else is in the menu? Nothing else, only love. Okay, so love is the only option. Yes, but you can choose. No, I cannot choose love if there is no second option. Okay, what's the second option? It's also love. That doesn't make sense. The second option has to be differently enough from the first one for it to be a genuine alternative and for it to be a genuine choice. You follow my point? Because if we don't have that, love is no longer voluntary. No long love is no longer a choice. It's just an imposition and you have no option. But that's not love. Love is a free, intentional, voluntary participation in relationship. So it has a risk because it opens the door for you can just so many other things apart from that. So when we choose something else, then we are talking here, ignorance, separateness, the pain and suffering that come from living such a life. Avidya, dvitiya, bhaya, no? Ignorance, dualistic thinking, us and them, fragmentation, fear, defense mechanisms, and all that snowball that comes after that. Which is a consequence of just not choosing love. And I'm not saying that for anyone to feel guilt. It's just for us to take responsibility. Okay, we are units of potential. We have free will. So we can always choose love. We can always choose something else. Krishna gives us that option because he loves us. No? Why? No, if he will love me, he will give me no option. Really? That's your version of love? That sounds pretty dysfunctional. Now, if my mom will love me, she will never give me any option. She will just dictate every single step of my life. That's a real loving mother. Manjula's, no. Thank you. Right? But it's a risk, no? Because as a mother, okay, I have my child. Of course, in the beginning, you cannot just allow your 3-month baby go and explore the wilderness. But at one point you have to let go, and it's risky and it's dangerous, and it's like, what may happen? She's going with her friends for the first time by herself, and now first date, and now who knows, whatever, no? What's her
Harry Ball.
Harry Ball? And it feels risky, right? But if you don't do that, that's even more risky. Now, if you keep your child in the what is below the house?
Cellar.
In the cellar.
Basement,
Yeah,
maybe.
basement. And you just feed him and give everything he needs. And no, you make a monster. You have a monster in the basement, right? Really? Really? So, how done to make your son or any of you a monster? You have to embrace the risk of love. And in that risk, many things can happen. Let's be honest. It's not that, okay, choose. And we always choose the best thing in the most enlightened way, not generally. And that creates all these sorts of life dynamics that we need to embrace to learn to love voluntarily, eventually, in the most enlightened way and choose that with the totality of our being. But we need to go through some trips in between and acquire some scars. Those will be our war battle medals or so to say. But as I say here, yet in the end, love is worth every risk. What love is, eventually, when we choose to love, when we experience that, we look back at all the risks we've taken, all the suffering we went through, all this stuff. It's all worthy. Not to say, let's go more for that, but just to say, love ends up justifying everything. It's so much what is awaiting for us in love that no matter what we have gone through, it's all somehow justified when we arrive to love. Again, I'm not promoting going through stuff. I'm just saying, in the face of love, everything else has its place and is put into context. In the vast expanse of human potential, both our brightest and darkest spectrums are boundless. Again, we are units of potential. This profound truth requires humility as we realize our capacity for both great good and great harm. With vivid strokes, the Bhagavad Gita sheds light on this darker side of potential. In verse 16:9, Krishna accurately describes those who, oblivious to love's possibilities, perform cruel deeds meant for the destruction of the world. So that's our potential. That's not, oh yeah, I know a person who does that. No, that's everyone's potential. The Bhakti tradition explains that evil arises from avidya, or ignorance, specifically ignorance of our divine potential. In this sense, evil could be defined as missed potential. So we do not over stigmatize evil, right? Like, so that such person is so evil, and we end up concluding that person is evil in at their core. No, there are no core evil people, at least not from our tradition's perspective. We can just speak about like extremely covered people, but in their core, the soul is always a Acharya. It's a unit of amazingness. But when we see someone that we are tempted to feel, oh, that person is made of evil to their marrow, that just shows how much we can be units of missed potential. How much we can miss the mark. Tupanandini, you have something?
When it says the evil arises from avidya, as Jiva Shakti, are we not in avidya, in ignorance, and we don't have avidya? But how does that start? We're not in knowledge in the first place to choose. I suppose I'm trying to find out that it's not my fault. I chose to be in Jiva. Well,
Yeah.
how is it?
I'll reply briefly because that topic can connect with many topics related to that, the sole origin of the jiva and related topics. But in brief, I will say that according to our tradition, avidya, well, the scriptures speak about anadi avidya, ignorance without beginning. But it doesn't mean that we never had an option to stop that. It means that just we have not done yet, but we have always the chance of stepping out of that ignorance and exploring our potential in other directions. And we have done that in one way or another, or not done that in one way or another. At the end of the day, I think it's good, and it's a complex subject in the sense that sometimes devotees will have another view, saying, okay, the soul was with Krishna in the spiritual world, and they chose to leave and fell, or some they were in Brahman, they fell. There are different ways of trying to make sense of, at the end of the day, why we are here, how to explain where we are here. And that difference of opinions, I have mine and you may have yours, a few. But I will say at the end of the day, all these different versions, that each of them have their pros and cons, try to make the point that we are invited to take responsibility for where we are. Not to play the blame game. Who is to blame? Because many times that's unconsciously aware why we are asking these questions. Okay, who is to blame to begin with? Krishna? Someone else? Me? And I wouldn't use the word blame. It's just we have free will, we are making our choices, and we are invited to take responsibility. And love is the ultimate responsibility. So in learning to take responsibility, we are learning to love. So again, we can speak about the soul as being affected by avidya or lacking love, lacking knowledge from time immemorial, time without beginning, whatever. But it doesn't mean that the options to connect with that love and knowledge were not available. They were always there. So did we choose it or not? Still here we are. So even again, it may be overwhelming trying to think and conceive in terms of millions of lifetimes. So we can go there for a moment, but at the end of the day, for me, the practical thing is go back here, October 8th, 2025, 11:10 a.m. I'm getting late with my class. And where we are now, here, and what do I do with my choices? I mean, where I am now, how do I take responsibility? How do I continue hopefully releasing avidya and embracing vidya and raja vidya? Right. I don't know if that helps. Okay, thank you. So again, evil is more, when we say someone did something evil, that was evil. Behind that evil is avidya. Again, there's not like an evil person who is evil to the marrow, to the core. It's just a very covert person that ends up doing things that are very harmful for others and for themselves. They are not aware of their highest self-interest. That shows the degree of the covering, and that should elicit compassion. Of course, sometimes practical action. Of course, if someone comes and wants to kill all of us, okay, let's be compassionate. Maybe we need to make arrangements so nobody of us is harmed. But at the end of the day, we should be compassionate. We should try to understand from which place that person came and not just put that person in the eternally evil souls or something box, right? But sometimes people in religion and spiritual circles do. Certain people are inherently evil and bad, and that creates a very like dualistic thinking. And there's always like some conspiratorial spirit. They are the evil ones, and what to speak if we believe there is someone called Satan or something, and it's always there trying to make you fall, and the bad guy who is trying to compete with God, and nobody can compete with God. We think we can and we try our best, and so many, but God is competing with his friends on a daily wrestling in Vrindavan. That's a competition, and he's defeated in that competition, right? With Sridham and the wrestling, but that's another story. Last paragraph from page 11. So evil could be defined as missed potential. Well, that's a more generous for me and compassionate understanding way of that's so evil. That speaks how much that person is missing their potential. Express their potential in the missed way, missing the mark of all that they can be. This insight brings us to the transformative power of deep compassion. There it is. Just as our capacity for both love and harm knows no bounds, so too does our ability to resonate with the suffering of others. In the intricate dance between love's light and its shadow, compassion emerges as a profound expression of love's boundless potential. This infinite potential serves a dual purpose. It dignifies the notion of potential itself, placing it in its true context and value, while also warning against the hazards of misplaced potentiality. So again, compassion, right? It's an expression of love. But when we witness evil, harm, missed potential in others or in us to begin with, because again, there are different degrees of missing the mark, right? It's not just you are becoming a totalitarian perpetrator and mass murderer. You can miss the mark on its small erosions of the ideal thing, and gradually, and that's sometimes how you end up being the worst of the worst, so to say. It's not that you begin day one of your birth in this lifetime Everyone knew as a one day baby, this person will be a dictator. No, probably you were a normal baby and yeah, with your karma from previous life, but eventually, gradually, you became the monster, so to say, right? So it's good to understand that process and what takes someone to behave in such those ways, and understand that, have compassion for that. But again, all this in the context of us being units of potential and not underestimating our potential for good and for not so good. No? A wise soul is a soul that is awakened and is sober, realizing both sides of the potential. Maybe at present, sometimes us, we may not be aware of these two. We are not aware of our brightest potential. We may not be aware of our darkest potential either. So the more you grow into one, the more you grow into the other also. In this sense, the more you grow into the brightest potential, you gain more awareness, more sensitivity to understand, oh, not the other way around, but in this way. The more you become awakened and enlightened and wise and mature and love more and more, you start to gain a consciousness of, uh-oh, if I express all this in this direction, this is disaster. So, not to become paralyzed and neurotic, just to take responsibility. That's why that's the price of love. The more you learn to love and grow in your potential, the more you become aware of your potential to do to miss the mark, and the consequence of that. And that's an awareness that haunts you. Not in any bad way. Hopefully not in any neurotic way, but just that it's there with you very clearly. And whenever you try to explore that, you are too aware of that. And if you do that, you will suffer because now you are too aware to awaken, and you are realizing, again, not to be neurotic, but just speaks about the sense how everything becomes more fine, more subtle. You become more sensitive also. Follow my point? Hopefully, I'm not discouraging you by saying all this. Oh, then I won't try to go there. I better become numb. I remain insensitive for the rest of my life. I'm not so happy, but I'm not suffering much. No? Right? So the more you love, the more you suffer. In one sense. In one sense. Not maybe suffer from the same place. Someone who doesn't love suffers, but is not so aware of their suffering. Makes others suffer. They are not aware of how much they make others suffer. The more you love, if casually you make others suffer, you will be aware of that. And the more you witness other people's ignorance, you will suffer in compassion, in love. So it's another type of suffering, another quality of suffering. But again, it's important to gain an awareness of our potential mission of the mark. I will say for most of us, being realistic, where most of us may be in the journey, and I don't want to give a diagnosis here. Okay, Radha Priya is in this chapter of the journey, and Sam is in this degree of the advancement scope. And I'm not here giving any of that. But generally, where most of us lie, we still have to how to say to consort with this stage called anartha nivritti. No? Have to be good husband and wife with that particular aspect of the journey. And anartha nivritti is not something bad, right? Anartha nivritti is in the context of what we are talking. I would say anartha nivritti means not only getting rid of bad stuff, and not only that happens automatically by me chanting my rounds that we were talking the other day. Okay, if someone practices devotion, he gets rid of anarthas. Yeah, but what does it mean to practice devotion? It's not just fulfilling the daily quotas, doing it with intention, with introspection, with so much inner content. And there are degrees of that. And anartha nivritti is not just things automatically get out of your inner shed. But also, anartha nivritti implies an active process of trying to be aware of what's getting in the way. Anartha may be something that gets in the way, that is preventing me from attaining my next higher potential. So what's getting in the way? I need to think about it. I need to be introspective. I need to look what's getting in the way. So trying to become aware, making the necessary effort to become aware of what's getting in the way, that's anartha nibbriti also. It's not just I chant my rounds and anarthas are gone. On some level, yeah, that's happening. I won't deny that. There are lots of things that we are getting rid of unconsciously without knowing. But there are some things that we could be conscious of, and we should be conscious of, and we should work on, right? Because of what's going on in the unconscious, many of us may have no clue. That there's so much in the unconscious that we are unconscious, maybe we are not conscious. Sometimes devotees ask Maharaj, how to deal with my unconscious? And first question for me is, well, first you deal with your conscious. Now, how to deal with the things I'm not conscious of? First deal with the things you are conscious of and that you are not dealing with. And the more you do that, then the unconscious comes to the conscious, and then you deal with that. And then another layer of unconscious comes to the conscious, and you deal with that. But if I make, and of course, to deal with what we are conscious of, first we need to be conscious of that. First we need to make an effort to, okay, where I am, what's going on, what's getting in the way, what can I see in my conscious awareness dealing with that. Then a layer of the unconscious then will come to the conscious realm. That's how Mahaprabhu starts his very first thing he ever wrote. Shikshastakam, right? Cheto darpanam arjanam. Clean the mirror of the unconscious. That's what it means. Cheto comes from citta, which means the subconscious mind. Darpanam arjanam, clean the mirror. So the more you clean it, dust will come. So it's another way of saying the more you work, as what I'm saying, on your conscious, what you can be conscious, what was unconscious comes to the conscious part. And you can work on that. And then you can work. So recognizing our darker impulses is not a detour. No? It's not a distraction. It's cetu darpanam arjanam. We are too silent. Sometimes we have to become serious. That's fine. That's why I use so much. I mean, not consciously, but intuitively, I feel the necessary. Okay, you have to make jokes in between because if not, they will kill you at the end of the class. Because in between the jokes, some pretty serious stuff is coming. So let's bring some humor to. But it's serious, right? Like Prabhupada once said, no, with this famous picture that Prabhupada appears to, like, I mean, there are many of them, very serious. That's like, why you're so serious? But then you see some other pictures and he's smiling in such a way that it's like, wow, such a smile, incomparable. And he will say, once they ask, but why are you so serious? Because Krishna consciousness is a very serious affair. It's not we're not joking here. Joking life. No? So when you live life seriously, you can also, I mean, there's place for laughter and joking and smiling, but there's seriousness as well. Because if not, if everything becomes humor, then you are taking the whole of life as a joke. And that's not. So again, maybe your silence a minute ago is in terms that we are talking serious stuff, we are talking about confronting the shadow, embracing our unconscious, embracing not even our unconscious, but the things that we know we could be conscious of. And I don't want to be conscious of that stuff. I don't want to be conscious of my ever-devolving potential. No, I resist. No, but what we resist persists, as the saying goes. So watch out with resistance. But it's interesting because many times, and here comes a paradoxical point. Many times we often resist not only having a taking a glimpse at our darkest potential, but we many times are also afraid of our brightest potential. That's very interesting. Speaking about paradox, I like to quote something. I'm including this in my next book. We will be talking about unconditional love and potential, but fear of potential. We are units of potential, but many times we are terrified about who we are. Potential, unlimited potential. Wow, that can be scary. I'm a walking unit of unlimited potential. Ooh, what to do? So there's an author, psychologist called Abraham Maslow. Maybe you may be aware of him. And he speaks about something he calls the Jonah complex. This coming from this famous character of the Bible, Jonah. You have Christ spoke about the sign of Jonah. And he's someone who was basically afraid of his potential. He was trembling before his highest possibilities. He writes the following, Abraham Maslow. Seatbelt
That's
fastened? Okay, good. Watch out for those chairs. Some of them are a little old, so you may break them. But we don't want to break. We don't want to break anything in there. He says, we fear our highest possibilities. We are generally afraid to become that which we can glimpse in our most perfect moments, under the most perfect conditions, under conditions of greatest courage. We enjoy and even thrill to the godlike possibilities we see in ourselves in such peak moments. We enjoy and even thrill in those moments, and yet we simultaneously shiver with weakness, awe, and fear before these very same possibilities. There's another quote from Marianne Williamson, very similar to this one, just to add another layer that she says, our deepest fear is like a summary of what I just shared. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frighten us. Interesting idea. I won't explain much about it. I will leave it more like as a koan for you to contemplate. Again, we have immense potential. What to do with that? Again, we have to take responsibility. We have free will. We have freedom. Sometimes we don't want freedom. Say, freedom, freedom. Okay, choose. You have unlimited energy and potential. Tell me what to do. Right? Well, and that's an interesting thing because the Bhagavad Gita, one of the first things that Krishna says in the beginning of the Gita, one of the concluding things that Krishna says at the beginning of the Bhagavad, at the end of the Gita is, do not fear. So we could read those lines here in this connection. Not Krishna at the end says, surrender to me completely, do not fear. But also we could say, well, we may be afraid not of surrender, we may be afraid of what comes after surrender. After I embrace my brightest potential. Ah, according to what we are just reading, I'm terrified about that. And Krishna is saying, don't fear. Don't fear your potential. Your fear, don't fear what comes by surrendering to me. Don't fear what comes as a result of that. Don't fear love. Don't fear you as a unit of love. Don't fear your brightest prospect. So again, we not only need to work on our wounds, ungrieved wounds, as we will try to do tomorrow in complement with this, but also we need to, how to say, we need to face the gravity of our potential in all these directions that we are mentioning. Darkest potential, brightest potential, the fear that may come. As I like to say sometimes, we may fear our potential just because it's unknown. We don't know all that we can be. And whatever is unknown generally unsettles us because it lies outside of the control and the predictable thing. I don't know what's all that I can be. I'm afraid. I don't know. So how to hold all this together, right? So let's do an exercise. Exercise that. Yeah. Simple one. I hope you all have paper and pencil. Pen, sorry. So the idea is simple. We'll try to do some shadow and let's call it shadow and brilliance. Dance. So for 3 minutes, and I will need the singing bowl next to me, please. So to mark. So for 3 minutes, it starts individually with you writing. So for 3 minutes, write about one moment where your potential was misdirected. When you missed the mark. And you knew, of course. And let write about it honestly, right? Without judgment, just I missed the mark. Ever devolving potential. I went in that direction. For 3 minutes. Try to write it with honesty. And then after 3 minutes, I will play the singing bowl. Brilliance glimpse. The other one was the shadow glimpse. Now 3 more minutes next. Write one, about one moment where you glimpsed about your highest possibility. Your brilliance, your nobility, who you are as a soul, a unit of unlimited potential, your light. And write about it freely also for 3 minutes. And then after those 3 minutes, we'll make groups. We'll be sharing with each other a little bit what came out. And how we felt about writing about that. And putting both things at both sides of the scale. Okay? So we'll start, and after we finish writing, 3 minutes, 3 minutes, I bring the bowl and we'll create the groups. We'll be sharing one sharing, again, as usual, for a few minutes. The others listening in silence, unconditionally bearing witness, taking turns. I will play in the bowl to indicate all that. Welcome back. Sorry if it was too short. It's always too short. And if you just got to share the first part of the exercise only, you can go to after the end of this sharing, you can continue sharing among yourself. We want to end on a bright note as well. There is hope. So, yeah, before concluding, since today in the evening we'll be having circle sharing, we won't be having Q&A. And if there's any questions or anything you may like to share before we put a rest to our sharing today, Magdalena.
It's just something that came while you were speaking, regarding, missing the mark. For a marksman, what they pay attention to a lot of factors in the environment. They when they miss their mark, they measure how much they missed, and then they take the like the wind. They take the wind into account and where they are in the trajectory and stuff. So I was thinking that that's kind of like our inner landscape to take factors into account, our internal environment. How much how are we missing the mark? And what direction is the wind blowing? Where's it coming from? How intense is it? What's pushing us?
PhD in archery. That's the goal of life, right? As we said the other day, we may do some private puja to Ramachandra, who seems to be good with bow and arrows. So. Nishra, you were raising your hand.
Was it, can I ask a question or is it just for sharing?
Yeah, whatever.
It's very effective. I just find it really well unsettled. Oh, yeah. So you said at one point in the class, you were saying, you can reach the darker potential if you allow that to happen. So the question is, when someone's so conditioned by trauma, how much do they really have free will to, because you see it, like you were talking the other day, most of these dictators and all of these people, they've had horrendous childhoods, but not everybody who goes through that trauma goes into that dark place. So just looking at that a little bit, how much is it sort of like difficult to not go in a dark direction because of trauma? Because you said, if you allow it to come back there.
That will be a question for tomorrow to Bhaktarasa, but of course I can say something and course, again, the soul in principle is a unit of free will, so it's not that we stop having free will. Of course, as you say, there may be layers of trauma and confusion and ignorance and how aware we are of certain things, how bewildered we are, how paralyzed we are. That's another story. And again, I'm talking in general because we cannot speak, every case is unique and different. But sometimes it may take time, of course. It's, again, go into our own journey. Not without talking about anyone else. Let's make it radically personal. Probably all of us have undergone some form of trauma. And it may took time for us to actually realize that we had trauma. It may took time for us to realize there was such a thing called trauma. We were living traumatized, but we didn't know that was the case. So it took time, but at one point we got to know about that, and we got to know what to do with that. And at one point we could look from the other side of the trauma bubble and oh, but it may have taken days, weeks, months, years, lifetimes. But the how to say the opportunities to heal, the opportunities to grow are always there in the environment. How much we take advantage of that, that's a separate conversation, and which are the reasons that prevent that from that. But again, at the end of the day, it's not about is there someone else to blame because of me going this, but accepting that we are going through that for whatever reason and previous choices, present choices, interacting with other people's will, and so on and so forth, and trying to always have this radical acceptance of what's happening, which of course I'm not saying it's an easy one, but that's the lesson that all of the great sages are trying to give, right? Okay. I'm not saying like passivity and fatalistic acceptance, like, okay, what's going on? I don't know. I don't do anything. I'm just, no, you have to do your part, but there are some things that are there, even despite what you try to do, they are still there. So accepting them, and of course, if we see that in others, I would say if we see people who are not seeing what we are seeing, hopefully that calls for compassion, and we can try to extend our hand. But also, it's up to them accepting that or not. And many times, they're not ready for that for whatever reason. Again, maybe trauma, and they may not be able to trust. And someone extends the hand, and it's like, but in time, there may be another perspective, another experience, the trauma, the experiences, the pain. We will talk about that surely tomorrow. Many times it opens many doors. Again, we're not here promoting masochism and let's suffer as much as we can, but also there is a purpose in pain and suffering. So I don't know if that
Yeah,
helps.
that, especially that first bit about it may take some time to see the truth, but then when you see it, then you can start.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And again, there may be things that are there that we cannot see yet, but there's always something we can see. No? Even if we are super covered and super traumatized and super everything, there's always something we can begin to see now in whatever condition we are. So we have to start there, even if it sounds absolutely like nothing. For us, but for someone else, that's a huge feat. That's what's necessary. And for other person, it's something else and something else. And again, help helps, receiving help, but sometimes we may not be, due to trauma, allow others to help us. And we may need to learn the lessons that come from not allowing ourselves to be helped. Again, not blaming anyone. It's not a blame game. That's a thing, an important thing to deconstruct. It's not like, so then who is to blame? Nobody's to blame. No, it's just love, free will, consequences, choices. Here we are, how we can move from where we are to the next best possible scenario, and from there to the next, and from there to the next. Yogamaya, you raise your hand.
It's going to comment that we do have freedom of choice, and often, you know, it's up to us to make the right decision or what we think is the right decision. So, You just mentioned it then, about tribes. So.
Okay. Yeah.
In the book, you say that until we acknowledge our dark potential, we cannot fully understand our capacity for good. So it seems like it's not so much of like an option or like nice thing to do, but that we have to do it in order to be able to see our, understand our bright potential. And then you were saying how the more we like, you know, go toward our bright potential, the more the darker stuff we see. So I'm just thinking like,
but with love and compassion.
Yeah, with love and compassion. But I'm just thinking then, like, is it that acknowledging the darker stuff first allows for more brighter potential, or that like we bring more brighter potential and darkness?
Sorry. Prabhupada will give that example. The more you wash the coal, the darker it becomes. That's an interesting one. So it doesn't mean that the more you purify yourself, the more contaminated you become. That's not the point. But it's the more you clean your heart, the more awareness you gain on the dust that still is there. And the more you embrace love and such a fine ideal, even a small thing, you will feel not as a small thing. This is something that has nothing to do with love, but maybe in a more covert situation, it's like, oh, it's okay.
Yeah.
Not a big deal. But the more you refine your heart, your sensitivity, or even that thing that another stage will be like, oh, it's good, it's great. Now it's like, not again, not neurotic, not traumatized, but just out of someone who is too awakened to not see that.
Yeah.
Right? That's basically the idea.
Yeah. And you know? So it kind of happens simultaneously.
Yeah. But again, it has to be in a way that is mentally sustainable. It's not that you are freaking out and becoming schizophrenic by looking at all and becoming traumatized, but just you gain a very fine awareness of those things, and you become so addicted to love that you really don't want anything getting in the way of that.
Yeah.
So you have that discipline with yourself in a loving way, that fine awareness, and when you see that in others, you see that in others, but again with love and compassion, not like labeling them and like horrified, I'm seeing such a degree of horrific dust covering the whole of you. If you will see what I see, you don't know the headache you are giving me by showing all your that. No, it's not nothing like that. It's like full compassion, because again, that person is seeing not only that dust, but is seeing exactly who we actually are. On the dust, but who we actually are on top of that. No? So it's all in context. Right? Yeah.
So that would also mean why, like, the advanced devotees, or the more, you know, someone has access to brighter potential, would feel like, oh, I'm such a sinful person, or, you know, even though it looks like, oh, you're such a wonderful person, but why do you feel like that? You know, like how we read from the advanced devotees kind of talking very low about themselves. You know, it's coming from that place.
Yeah. I mentioned that in my book. Remember when Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, I'm full of lust. That's a good one. What to do with that? Is Bhaktivinoda Thakur full of lust? He's doing a public confession? No. Is he writing the song thinking, okay, I will write the song for those guys who read my songs and will be full of lust, actually, so they can relate to it. So I will fake that I'm full of lust, so it's just to make them relatable. No, he's not doing that. So he's having so much love, but having that love makes him see how much more love can be had. And in comparison to that, he feels, I have nothing. Not only is he, I have nothing, he says, I'm full of lust. That's very paradoxical. We cannot maybe fully understand until we are there. When you are there, it's like, it makes sense. Right? Hey, Mahaprabhu, as he said the other day, he said, I have no love, not even the aroma of love. He's full of love. He's made of love. So it's very paradoxical. We need to understand how those paradoxes operate so we don't feel that's contradictory, that's wrong, what's going on there, that's undesirable, why they are saying that, they seem to feel miserable about themselves, maybe low self-esteem problem there. No, it's not that. But we have to understand so we don't copy-paste that, do it that in our stage and become dysfunctional ourselves. Right? So. Yeah. Okay. 12, midday. Something else before putting the sharing to rest. Before concluding, one Lectio Divina for today. We'll have time for Lectio Divina. Of course, I assume some of you may be tempted to do Lectio Divina with the quotes I share from Abraham Maslow about brightness potential. You want to let me know and I can send that to you. But I have another one in mind. It's a short poem by Saint Francis of Assisi. Let's go back to Saint Francis. In the rendering of Daniel Ladinsky. So it's short, so I will read it and you can write it down. It's not so long. In connection to what we just explored in terms of shadow and brilliance. So let me read it completely first, so you can hear it, be present, then I repeat it and you take note of that. So it's called Humility and Compassion. Just three lines. Can true humility and compassion exist in our words and eyes unless we know we too are capable of any act? So it's basically what we were talking today, but in poetry from Saint Francis. So Saint Francis is supporting my case. I will read it again slowly. You can take note of that. So can true humility and compassion exist in our words and eyes?
And what?
Eyes. Can true humility and compassion exist in our words and eyes unless we know we too are capable of any act? Unless we know we too are capable of any act, and ends with an interrogation mark, right? So, rhetorical question. I'll read it one more time. Can true humility and compassion exist in our words and eyes unless we know we too are capable of any act? So you can sit with Saint Francis from 6 to 5 with this poetry. 5 to 6, sorry. I said 6 to 5 a few times already.
Yeah.
So we'll put this, yeah. We'll put the sharing to rest now. Today in the evening we're having circle sharing, and tomorrow we'll be having grief exploration the whole day, and the next day in the morning meeting as well. No? So just for us to be aware. And one more thing, but let me put pause here. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki.
Yes.